It's the 1984 Surveillance State edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, do we live in a 1984-esque surveillance state? The answer will surprise you, as well as a classic interview with Phil Plait of Bad Astronomy. Let's begin episode 231.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks, we are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other sun. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, listeners. I am Don, your political science philosopher, alone again in the studio. Today's rant is about one line.
In terms of such opponents, I couldn't care less what they say. We will do the right thing.
Now, this line is lifted from context, but it does express the philosophy of the Harper government. When the majority of farmers wanted to keep the Canadian wheat pool, what did Harper say?
I couldn't care less.
When the police chiefs of Canada asked Harper to hold on to the long gun registry, that it was needed to keep people safe, what did Harper say?
I couldn't care less.
When the majority of people, and more specifically the citizens of Vancouver, begged Harper to keep the safe injection site open, what did Harper say?
I couldn't care less.
And yet some people still vote for him. He offers us the ability to select channels we want from cable and not just the bundles they offer, and more regulations for roaming charges, as if he can buy off Canadian public with trinkets while wasting billions on fighters we don't need and more billions on frigates that cost 10 times more than they should. Now, the mounting Senate scandal may be the rock that drops the conservative Goliath. It seems appropriate that when the most popular TV heroes, in scare quotes of course, is Heisenberg from Breaking Bad, Mike Duffy, a bad person and probable criminal, has risen to hero status for his effective attack he has made on the PMO. The latest news is the RCMP are investigating the PMO's office to see if Harper illegally manipulated a senator and the Senate itself. I doubt anyone listening has any doubt that Harper did instigate the bailout of Duffy's debt to the Canadian public. Harper is famous for his micromanagement tendencies. Claiming he knew nothing about the shenanigans revolving around Duffy and the Senate scandal are preposterous to believe. It has gotten so bad that even the base of the Conservative Party are beginning to rumble that it is time for a new leader. Sadly, thanks to Harper's manipulation of his ministers, there is only one real kind of contender, and that's Jason Kennedy. So it doesn't seem likely that anytime soon Harper will be gone. So it seems we will have two more years to put up with this farce. But let's not forget 2015. We're going to go for a break, and when we return, do we live in a 1984-esque surveillance state?
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Approximately 200 days ago, a young new employee of Booz Allen, a contractor for the American National Security Agency, mysteriously disappeared from his home in Hawaii. He reappeared in Hong Kong several days later when the world learned the name Edward Snowden. And ever since, this whistleblower has been shedding light on the depth and length of the surveillance state, not only in the US, but other nations as well, including Canada. One of the unintended consequences of this event was shortly after Snowden's first interview with the Guardian reporter Glenn Greenwald, the sales of George Orwell's dystopic novel 1984 rose by over 4,000%. For those who may not have read the novel or seen any of its adaptations, the basic premise of the novel can be summed up as a totalitarian surveillance state. The leader of the state was Big Brother, a term we now see as synonymous with government spying. Here's what the author had to say about the future.
But he left one final warning.
1984 is, I believe, a quite terrifying masterpiece. So terrifying, in fact, I don't think I should like to read another like it.
Something like 1984 could actually happen. This is the direction the world is going in at the present time. There will be no loyalty except loyalty to the party. But always there will be the intoxication of power. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
Now, there are a number of things that are similar to 1984 and other things that are not. I thought I would take a quick look at just how much 1984 is in the now, and more specifically, do we live in a 1984-esque surveillance state? As a good skeptic, the first thing we should ask, what makes a surveillance state? First, can the government keep a constant eye on us? In the novel 1984, every person had a state-controlled TV in the room, which had the ability to surveil the entire room. The idea is there was not a corner you could go to have a private conversation. If you were doing something nonconformist, you were told so via the TV. The role of the TV in the novel, and emphasized throughout the novel, is the idea of personal space. Having a private moment or conversation was impossible. Big Brother was always watching you, so you'd better conform or else. Obviously, George L. got this wrong. Or did he? How many of our listeners right now have a cell phone on them? This single device is a fountain of metadata that is constantly tracking where you are, what you're doing, as well as who you're contacting. One of the things that has come to light is not only that the government collects your metadata, but it can do so without any real oversight. Supreme Court decisions in the U.S. have stated that metadata is not protected by your right of privacy. Our own Supreme Court has yet to rule on this issue, but it is telling that it was not until the revelations of Snowden that a case brought by the BC Civil Liberties Association and Open Media has even been attempted. In fact, with very few exceptions, anything that is not explicitly a phone conversation or written correspondence is deemed to be public and thus not protected. Remember when you signed up for your Skype account or Gmail or whatever? In the legalese, you signed over your privacy rights to the host company. When you did this, you also waived your rights to privacy vis-a-vis the surveillance state. Now you might say, what the heck is metadata? Metadata, with regards to your phone, is everything but the conversation. Your cell phone contains a plethora of sensors, everything from GPS, accelerometers, temperature sensors, compasses, and much, much more. In many ways, this information can be more revealing than the actual spoken part. You might ask, well, how is this non-talking part of my call more revealing than the talking part? Let's envision a classic call. Hello, honey. Sorry, I'm going to be a little late. Eat supper. I should be home by 10. Gotta work. That's the call. From that, you would guess that he is at work being productive. However, if we look at the metadata, we find the call was made while he was driving into a red light district, that he used his phone to pay for parking at a particular address, that after their call to their honey, they made another call. You cross-reference that number to a directory database, and you find the number for Lonely Lovers, Inc. You can see by their GPS that the phone stopped at the address of said Lonely Losers. It also showed that the person stayed there for about 90 minutes, and that their phone directed all send calls to the voicemail. Well, I could go on, but you get the message. You could find out a lot from metadata, perhaps much more than listening in. In this thought experiment, the conversation painted a very different and inaccurate picture of the scene than the metadata did. The metadata never lies. It has also come to be known that not only are they collecting this metadata, but every time you send an email, it is being scanned for content. This is done by your service provider, such as Google. Read terms and conditions. And as we will learn later, the government as well. One hypothetical to make the point about metadata. Imagine how you would feel if you woke up one morning and saw someone going through your garbage. What if they did that every day? What if they didn't actually take anything, but they made notes about what you threw out, where you shopped, your bills, who sent you mail? Likely you'd be outraged. You'd call the cops. How would you feel that if every time you looked around the corner, there was someone taking a note about where you were, who you talked to, what you bought, what time you got to work, when you left? This is what we're talking about with regards to metadata. It is the fact that metadata, well, data in general, is virtual. You can't see it, touch it, or smell it. This virtualness allows us to overlook the fact that it is real and can affect our lives. As more and more of our lives are lived online, the less privacy we really have. So whereas the 1984 state had to create an elaborate network of TVs in every room, we have voluntarily bought our own personal surveillance device and dutifully carry it with us 24/7. So the state has the capability to keep a constant eye on us. In fact, to a far greater degree than Orwell could have possibly imagined. The latest to surface is that the NSA has hacked into computers at the major companies such as Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and others, and, quote, hoovered up data traffic between these companies' data centers. This is where we store all our information in the cloud. It's our online chats, our email. It's pretty much everything we have online. This activity is supposed to be governed by special courts or crown ministers. However, these restrictions only apply to internal spying. These agencies are given pretty much carte blanche when spying on other nations. Now, you may have noticed I switched from the singular to the plural. Canada is part of a group known as the Five Eyes, a group set up during World War II where each country's spying agency would be pooled and share intelligence. This group includes the US, UK, Australia, and New Zealand. This means that while our own CSEC, that's Communication Security Establishment Canada, well, CSEC has restrictions for spying on Canadians, there are none for its spying on Americans. Conversely, the NSA has no restrictions for spying on foreigners, such as you and me. Couple this with the fact that much of the telecommunication traffic travels through the US at some point, regardless of sender-receiver, that they have the ability essentially to track it all. What do I mean by all of it? The NSA is about to open a new data center with a storage capacity of 1 yottabyte. A yottabyte is 1 trillion terabytes. Currently, the annual internet traffic, i.e. all the data on the internet, is approaching 1 zettabyte. This NSA center could store 1,000 years worth of this internet. All the data. Now, I'd like to tell you what the capacity of the CSEC was, but our nation's passion for top secret outstrips the US, and that was information I could not find or didn't seem to be available. So it seems that not only has the state the ability, but the willingness to track everyone. And what do I mean by that? In the news recently, we learned that Canada has been spying on the President of Brazil. It was revealed that the US has tapped German Chancellor Merkel's phone for over a decade. The classic example for the reasoning for the surveillance state is to stop terrorism. But it seems hard to understand why they would need to tap our allies' communication. This is not unique to the US or Canada. The G20 meeting in London in 2009 had special internet cafes set up to facilitate the monitoring of the communications of the attending parties. The recent G20 in Russia similarly had revelations about attempted spying. Okay, now most of us, we likely know, at least to some degree, surveillance was going on. Let us not forget the growing networks of CCDs on street corners. During the Olympics here in Vancouver, we all knew we were being watched. But many of us should be shocked at the total magnitude of the spying going on. Now, some people say, well, I have nothing to hide, and that may be true. But the government is storing your data for years, decades, centuries. Well, what if your name is similar to a real suspect, or there's a typo, or someone just gets it wrong? They can then go back through this data, and then you have what us skeptics like to call anomaly hunting. Did you know that when you bought that latte at Starbucks, the head of the Gambino family was also enjoying a coffee there? And how do you explain that you bought a propane tank just 2 days before one was used to kill a Gambino rival? And so it goes. In the world of boundless informant and total information awareness, innocence and nothing to hide may only be lame excuses for someone committing pre-crime. Okay, but the surveillance was only part of the state control. Another vital aspect was the ability to control the past. As put in the movie 1984, he who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. This played out in 1984 where hordes of bureaucrats, would pore over newspapers to make corrections. That is, change things like, let's say someone in the government predicted that a crop production for a particular year would be 12 billion tons. Then it turned out the year yield was only 10 billion. It would be the job of these people to find all the articles that printed the 12 billion number, white it out, and replace it with 10 billion. Thus, every statement the party said was correct. Now again, hampered by reality and the inability to see the rise of the digital age, the mechanism Orwell thought of would not likely have done what he intended it to do, i.e. whitewash history. But is it possible now? If you think about it, as more and more of our correspondence is online, we get our news from the internet, our research for topics like this is largely done via digital libraries of the world. There are magnitudes more information published online than in the real world. There are constant efforts to digitize printed material, so it will not be lost to time, as all real objects will eventually disappear. Now couple this with the fact that more and more of our online data is being housed in fewer and fewer entities. We no longer store our documents on our PC, but upload them to Google Docs or some other cloud service. It is estimated that Google alone has at least 10 exabytes of data stored in its data farm. How much is 10 exabytes? Well, all the data created by humanity from the dawn of awareness to 2003 equals about 5 exabytes. So what happens if someone decides to edit history? In Orwell's time, you would need to recall every offending newspaper to edit them and then redistribute them. Now all you need is a digital worm or virus that will weave its way through the data centers of the world, altering their files. In one simple step, you now control the digital past. So far we have seen, not only do we have the surveillance state, but in many ways it's far worse than Orwell protected. So does this mean we live in a totalitarian surveillance state? Well, I only have a few minutes to retrieve society from Big Brother's boot, so here goes. The short answer, do we live in a totalitarian state? No. Although it is much more possible for this dystopia of 1984 to become real, there are significant numbers of missing factors. We do not have a one-party state. Now, it is possible that the corporocracy that we now experience will become a ruling class and emulate the party, but as yet, it only has significant influence and not total control. We still live in a democracy. We still have the possibility to take control of our lives. In 1984, there was no civil dissent. Although, through events like Toronto's G20, one could make the argument that civil dissent has been greatly reduced. But there is still space, for now, for political dissension, for debate. Implicit in the novel is journalism being complicit with the state. And although mainstream media has followed this line, there is still a significant alternative press to ensure that we do not succumb to newspeak. Although much of our media is intended to distract us from real issues of state, there are venues for people to not only become aware, but on rare occasions, do something. Now, although torture does seem to be an acceptable practice now, it is still limited in its application, so we do not have to worry about thought crime yet. If there is one thing you should take away from this talk, it is not to be afraid, but to be pissed off. We are well on our way to a world envisioned in 1984. I have covered only one aspect, the surveillance state. But if we walk complacently into the future, allow our government to do things that are antithetical to democratic society, well, who knows? Allowing the creation of the precondition for a totalitarian state, we may then be condemned to live in 1984 forever. A last word from the author.
The moral to be drawn from this dangerous nightmare situation is a simple one. Don't let it happen. It depends on you.
Radio Free Thinker will return after this break.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world works.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
Next on Radio Free Thinker, we have a classic interview with Phil Plait of Bad Astronomy.
Hello, listeners. We're back with a special guest in our virtual studio. Today we have Dr. Philip Plait, a.k.a. the Bad Astronomer, an internationally renowned author, astronomer, and lecturer. His blog, badastronomy.com, has just been rated by Time magazine as one of the top 25 blogs on the internet. Time says his blog regularly battles the misuses of science in daily life, in addition to praising the wonders of legitimate research. Hello and welcome, Dr. Plait.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
As our listeners know, this show is intended to present and promote a skeptical view of the world, to show why it's necessary and what dangers arise from a lack of skepticism. For you, what does it mean to be a skeptic?
Well, for a lot of people, what they think of when they think of the word skeptic is someone who denies something or someone who's cynical. But that's not really it at all. A skeptic is just someone who wants evidence. If you present an idea, we don't just believe you. The idea is that you need to show us what evidence you have for that claim. So if you say, a ghost visits me every night, and I'll ask you, what evidence do you have for that? And you say, well, I see it. And then I can say, well, you know, studies have shown that when you're waking up and you're half awake and half asleep, it's easy to see stuff like that. I need photographs. I need more evidence than that. And so that's what it is to be a skepticism. It's not to deny stuff. It's just to ask for the evidence. Probably the most ironic thing about being a skeptic is when people say, you're a skeptic, you're closed-minded. And in fact, we're quite the opposite. We're open-minded. Somebody who believes in one of these things typically is closed-minded to the idea that they might be wrong, whereas a skeptic is always, in the back of your mind, always thinking, am I wrong about this? And if I am, what is correct? We want to find out what the truth is. And so therefore, you have to always be open to new evidence.
Do you think there's a moral weight upon those who propose these pseudosciences? I notice you've written a few articles about the anti-vax movement and the deaths that have resulted from this movement.
That's been something of a soapbox for me lately because it's getting to be a much stronger movement. Jenny McCarthy, the ex-actress, is promoting the idea that vaccines are linked with autism. And we are completely sure they're not. All the studies show they're not. And yet she and other people who are strong in the anti-vax movement are saying things that are demonstrably incorrect. And what's happening is we are seeing the effect. Vaccination rates are becoming lower in places like Australia, places where people are getting fewer vaccinations, and we're seeing measles outbreaks, whooping cough. There's a whooping cough outbreak in New South Wales, which is where Sydney is. I mean, this is not some backwater place. This is an urban area. And kids are dying. A little girl died of whooping cough very recently because she was too young to get vaccinated, but there were not enough people in her area who had been vaccinated, and you lose the herd immunity, this idea that if enough people are vaccinated, there's no place for the disease to live, and it goes away. Because the vaccination rates were low, this poor little girl got whooping cough, and she died from it. That's the result of uncritical thinking, of believing in stuff without looking at the evidence.
Do you think that vaccination should be mandatory?
Oh, boy, I don't know. And that's one of those things where that's a difficult, difficult decision. It's for the good of the public to have a 90 to 95% vaccination rate. And you're talking about saving lives. But it's no different than the arguments about wearing a motorcycle helmet or forcing people to wear a seatbelt. You're infringing on their liberties. And, you know, is it legal or is it correct for the government to legislate things for your own good? And we do that all the time. But at some point, it becomes a difficult decision. And honestly, I would need to really think about that and hear both sides, because right now I don't know. I think you shouldn't have to vaccinate necessarily, but it's the right thing to do. And the problem is, you know, that it would all be great if everybody did base their actions on all the evidence and what is the right thing to do. The problem is people don't. And so then you have people dying. And so it becomes a very difficult decision.
I mean, there's been a lot of aggressive education to try and counter the anti-vax movement. What else do you think can be done?
I don't know, to be honest, because these people don't, the people who are anti-vax are not weighing the evidence fairly and coming to a rational decision. They're basing it on things like, I gave my six-month-old daughter a shot and now she's autistic. And so it's not a rational decision that's been made. And I'm not saying it's irrational and crazy. I'm just saying rational, meaning it's not based on the evidence. A lot of things happen at the same time as other things. You can eat a sandwich and then the mail comes, but that doesn't mean every time you eat a sandwich, the mail's going to come. Vaccinations are given around the same time that symptoms of autism arise. That doesn't mean they're related to each other physically. It just means that they happen around the same time. So it's very difficult when somebody has made a decision based on this sort of faulty logic to reason your way out of it. And so these people aren't crazy. They're not stupid. They're just being human. And so when that something like that happens, it's really hard. We all have, I have, I hate to say beliefs, but ideas that are based more on emotion than rationality. And, you know, if somebody tried to convince me that Doctor Who is a terrible show, I would argue against them. It's a great show. I love it. But that's not a rational argument. It's one based on emotion. And so it's a very difficult one to win.
I remember listening to NPR Science Friday, and they had a caller come in, and they did the same thing. They said, you know, well, with this evidence, with that evidence, is there any evidence? And they said, no, there is no evidence. I can understand that kind of problem. You've created the blog, badastronomy.com. Is that one of your ways of trying to fight this, well, not this movement in particular, but the ignorance in general, perhaps, or the...
The scourge.
Yes.
Yes, that's it exactly. I started the website back in 1993. I got the domain name in 98. And it was basically just to counter myths and misconceptions about astronomy. It grew and grew. I started a newsletter. And then back in 2003, I think it was. I should really try to find out when I started it. No, it was 2005. That's right. I started the blog. And then in 2008, for those of you keeping notes at home, Discover Magazine... basically, they bought the blog. They made me an offer, and I moved it over there. And so now it's hosted. It's actually blogs.discovermagazine.com/badastronomy. And if you go to badastronomy.com, it takes you right to my blog. And it's more than just astronomy now. It's science in general. I fight against creationism. I fight against the anti-vax movement. All sorts of things. It's whatever I think happens to be important, and that I have enough information that I feel I'm comfortable talking about.
Mainstream media, often under the guise of being balanced or fair, provides a platform for things like intelligent design, homeopathy, or the anti-vax movement to spew their, crap. Do you think mainstream media should take a stronger moral stance against these propagators of ignorance?
Yes. Oh, you want more? Yes, they should. Look, like I tell people, if you're talking about an issue like abortion, reasonable people can come down on opposite sides of an argument like that. And I can come up with 100 other political examples about this. When it comes to things like science, there is not two equal sides to this. And so if you're saying, I think the moon landings are faked, you're wrong. Okay. And so if somebody comes on TV and they want to see a debate between a scientist, like say me, and somebody who says the moon landings are faked, it's already not a fair fight, because you've got somebody who is just simply dead wrong and spewing irrationality against somebody who has, you know, basically reality on their side. The news, they love to say we have both sides of this issue, of this controversy. But it's a manufactured controversy. It's not a real controversy. There is no scientific controversy about vaccines and autism. We know, the studies have shown, there is no relationship. Vaccines do not cause autism. We can state this factually. So if you have somebody who says that that's wrong, you're already giving them way more credence than you need to. The problem is the media are used to giving both sides of an issue. The problem is that sets up a false dichotomy, and then somebody might say, well, the truth sometimes, you know, lies somewhere in between. But you know what? If I take a cannon and shoot you with it, you're dead. And if you claim, no, I'm not, the truth is not somewhere in between. The truth is you're dead. And so that's the kind of thing that you have to think of when you see a debate between two people where they're arguing a scientific issue like the age of the universe or vaccines or evolution being a fact.
One of the best defenses against ignorance and the peddlers of pseudoscience is education. But it's hard to keep up these days. Are there any sources you would recommend for our listeners? Besides
well,
your blog, which is
the Bad Astronomy blog. In fact, there are three major forces in critical thinking in the United States, and that would be the James Randi Educational Foundation, which I'm the president of, and that's randi.org. I imagine your listeners are familiar with it, randi.org. There's Michael Shermer's group, the Skeptics Society, out in California, and there's the Center for Inquiry, headquartered out of New York, CFI. And all three of these organizations are dedicated to promoting critical thinking and keeping up with what's going on out there. There are a million blogs. If you're interested in science-based medicine, if you're interested in the fight against the religious fundamentalists and creationism, there are blogs out there for you. The thing to do is to go find one or two blogs like that and then check their links, and you'll find far more than you could possibly read in a day.
Radio Free Thinker will return after this break.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
Hello, listeners. We're back with a special guest in our virtual studio. Today we have Dr. Philip Plate, a.k.a. The Bad Astronomer, an internationally renowned author, astronomer, and lecturer. His blog, badastronomy.com, has just been rated by Time magazine as one of the top 25 blogs on the internet. Time says his blog regularly battles the misuses of science in daily life, in addition to praising the wonders of legitimate research. Hello and welcome, Dr. Plate.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You've been quite busy lately. We're trying to track you down with that. You're an astronomer, science reporter, and of course there are hundreds of stories on your blog. What do you think right now is the biggest or most important thing going on in astronomy?
The biggest and most important thing. There are a couple of things. The most important one scientifically, I think, might be the investigation of dark matter and dark energy, because these are two aspects of the universe that we don't understand very well. Dark matter is a type of matter that is dark. We can't see it, but we can see its effects. And we're pretty sure it's out there. There's tons of evidence for it. There are some alternative theories, but I don't think they hold any water, at least not yet. There's not enough evidence for them. But we don't know what dark matter is. We don't know, you know, is it particles that we don't understand or what it is? And dark energy is even worse because we haven't really characterized it as well as even dark matter. And it's some sort of thing that's out there that is making the expansion of the universe get faster every day. We know the universe is getting bigger every day. We've known that since early in the 20th century. But it was only in 1998 when it was discovered that that expansion is accelerating. It's getting faster. And we don't know anything about this. And so these kind of studies are probably the most important scientifically. I think the most important one popularly, and may in the long run be more important even scientifically, is the search for planets around other stars. This was first discovered, planets around stars like the Sun, in 1995. And in just a few years, we have over 300 of these things known. And we're getting so good at it that the masses of these things are getting lower and lower, the kind that we can find. And we are right on the thin, hairy edge of finding a planet with the mass of the Earth orbiting a star at about the same distance the Earth is. NASA just launched the Kepler mission, which is looking for planets like this. When they pass in front of the starlight dips just a little bit. And Kepler can see that. And if an Earth-like planet is orbiting a Sun-like star, it'll be able to detect this. So in a couple of years, we may actually know of a dozen of planets like this.
I know some of the advancements in the science and the mathematics involved to do these discoveries are quite inspiring. You have a new book out, well, it was published late last year, called Death from the Skies, These Are the Ways the World Will End. Now, forgive me for saying this, but this title doesn't seem to be a standard skeptical type book. It sounds a little apocalyptic.
In fact, one of the things I do is I try to fight people who are scaring people for a living in thinking that the Earth is going to come to an end because of the Mayan prophecy of 2012 or back in 2003, people who thought a Planet X was going to sweep by the Earth and kill us all. There's all these people out there trying to do this, but that's all nonsense. What my book is solid science, talking about asteroid impacts, talking about solar flares or the eventual death of the sun. A nearby supernova, all of the realistic scientific ways that I could think of that could damage or destroy life on Earth. Now, the idea of a black hole passing through the solar system and gobbling down the Earth, the odds of that happening even over the next trillion years are essentially zero. But it's kind of a fun thing to think about. And you can and say, look, what is a black hole? How do they work? What would happen if it did pass through the Earth? The whole time, though, I'm also saying the odds of this happening are essentially zero. Don't worry about this. Worry more about asteroid impacts, which have a much higher chance of happening. But in fact, we can do something about to prevent.
So essentially, your book is different from those other ones because you take the scientific approach.
Yeah, mine's real.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I've got the math and the science to back mine up. I'm just not making stuff up.
Is there anything, one thing you wanted people to take away after reading your book?
There are two takeaway messages from my book, and they're sort of opposite sides of the same coin. And that is that the odds of a black hole, well, a black hole passing by the Earth, a star exploding near the Earth, all that kind of stuff, the odds of these happening are so low, you just don't have to worry about it. The flip side of it is that the things that can and will happen, an asteroid impact or a giant solar flare, are things that we can do something about. And so honestly, the things that are really super scary, you don't have to worry about. And what we should be worrying about are the things that we can actually do something about. That's what I want people to understand.
So the CERN is not a big big issue for you, and space exploration, getting the diaspora of humanity in space, you think is a good thing?
Well, I'm not too concerned if you're talking about the Large Hadron Collider creating a quark nugget or a mini black hole. No, it's not going to happen. But yeah, I would like to see us getting into space. I don't think it's a practical matter to spread humanity to the stars just yet. But I would like to see a moon base. I would like to see us visiting near-Earth asteroids, which turns out to be actually a lot easier to do than getting to the moon, which is kind of surprising. And making sure that if something does happen to the Earth, we do have humanity spread out someplace else so that we can continue.
Coincidentally, the Star Trek movie was released, and the last mission to Hubble telescope occurred during the week of the 50th anniversary of C.P. Snow's provocative The Two Cultures lecture, which lamented about the gulf between scientists and literary types, i.e. there's a culture of science and it seems to be separate from the culture of literature. Do you think entertainment has a role in promoting science literacy?
Oh, absolutely. You got to realize a lot of scientists froth and foam about inaccurate science in movies, and I used to be one of them. And some people still accuse me of that because I do review the astronomy and the science of movies on my blog. I just did the Star Trek movie, in fact. But you got to understand it. In many cases, it's done with love. Not every case, because I thought Armageddon was the most atrocious movie ever made. So it's actually with some amount of glee that I attacked it. But in fact, you know, these movies inspire a generation of kids. I watched Star Trek when I was a kid. I'm of the age where Lost in Space and Space 1999 were on when I was at just the right age to really want to go into space and explore all these strange new worlds. And so Star Trek and these other movies, Star Wars and everything that comes out, even if it's just, you know, borderline fantasy, I think is getting people to look up, getting them to think beyond themselves. Maybe it's only a fraction of the audience will go out and pick up a hard science fiction book or even one about space propulsion. But you know what? Maybe that person wouldn't have done it at all if that movie hadn't have been made. So if they're going to make the movie anyway and get a lot of people entertained by it, I think inspiring a generation to explore space is a good idea. And just to end that thought, go and ask any astronaut who's 40 years old right now why they're an astronaut and, you know, what inspired them as a kid. And they will all say, oh yeah, Star Trek.
Cool. On a related note, there have been attempts to rewrite science textbooks to make them more what I'd call fundamentalist friendly. In Canada, we have a similar movement here. There's an attempt to add into the human rights an ability for parents to withdraw their children from science classes that deal specifically with religious topics. What do you think are the dangers posed by these revisionist type movements?
Well, they're wrong, first of all. You're basically taking away a person's chance to think critically. You know, it's not that big of a deal if in daily life you're trying to decide which shampoo to use, and you saw a commercial for one, and the model's hair looked beautiful, so you're going to buy that shampoo. But that is an example of uncritical thinking, of argument from authority or something like that. if you're raising a generation of people who cannot think critically, then they're going to buy a car that is going to kill them or vote for a politician who is going to make laws that are against their own best interest. You have to know how to think critically. And part of the problem is we're not even teaching science as a process. We're teaching it as a series of facts. You know, memorize these dates, memorize these equations, as opposed to it being, let's investigate a claim. That is science. Skepticism and science are basically the same thing. We have, you know, we have an idea to explain something we've seen. Let's test it and see what's going on. That is both skepticism and science. What these anti-science people are doing, what the creationists are trying to do and the fundamentalists are trying to do, is take that away and say, we are going to teach your kids to believe in our narrow view of reality, which in my opinion, and I've got a gazillion scientific facts to back me up, is wrong, and they shouldn't be doing it. And in fact, I know this is not true in Canada, but in the United States, it's against our Constitution. So they had to take creationism and put it in a cheap suit and call it intelligent design, but it's still creationism. They did that to get around the First Amendment that says you can't teach religion. It's more complicated than that, but that's what it boils down to here. And it's wrong. They shouldn't be doing it. And it's something that is, it's just against what America stands for.
Well, thank you, Dr. Plate, for taking the time to share your views with us. I don't think I'll be speaking out of place if I say our audience greatly appreciates it. Any last words for our listeners?
Yeah, you know, two things. One is keep using your brain. It's not a muscle, but it might as well be. The more you use it, the stronger it gets. And you know what? Every time you go outside and it's clear out and the moon's not up maybe, or even if the moon is up, take a look. Look up at the sky and see what you see and think about what you're seeing and understand that we understand what's going on up there, a lot of it. And the more we learn, the more there is to learn and the more fun this stuff gets.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio Free Thinker will return after this break. Zines, magazines, books, art, crafts, readings, performances, lectures. Do you like these things?
Yeah.
Do you like when these things are made by indie artists in your community?
Yeah.
Then come on down to Canzine West, the greatest festival of zine and independent culture, brought to you by Broken Pencil Magazine, on Saturday, November 2nd from 1 to 7 p.m., at the Ukrainian Hall at 805 Pender Street East.
Well, that's all we've got for this week. For those of you who are interested, there are some interesting elections south of the border, in particular Virginia. And it's just been reported that Rob Ford has actually admitted to smoking that crack cocaine after all. It seems like the news reports and the video were real and honest, unlike the politician at the heart of it all. Is this the end of Ford Nation? Who knows? But with luck, it will be, along with Harperland. Anyhow, this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelation.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts on Commercial Drive and in other areas at
Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, BAM Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling.
keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
One species turn into another.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Only the fittest survive, and that was the key. Natural selection. That was the key.
We are surrounded by endless forms, most beautiful, most wonderful. Evolution, the greatest show on earth. There is grandeur in this view of life. Most beautiful, most wonderful. Evolution, the greatest show on earth.
Life can be thought of as a many-branched tree. The five kingdoms of life were established early on. Bacteria, protists, amoeba-like creatures, fungi, plants, and animals.
We find ourselves perched on one tiny twig, in the midst of a blossoming tree of life. Perched on one tiny twig, of a blossoming tree of life.
Only the fittest survive, and that was the key. Natural selection. That was the key.
We are surrounded by endless forms, most beautiful, most wonderful. Evolution, the greatest show on earth. There is grandeur in this view of life. Most beautiful, most wonderful. Evolution, the greatest show on earth. We are surrounded by millions of other species, walking, flying, burrowing, stalking, chasing, fleeing, outpacing.
Animals strive to reach this one ultimate goal, to ensure the survival of the next generation. This one ultimate goal, to pass on their genes. And that is what life is all about, is all about.
There is grandeur in this view of life. Most beautiful, most wonderful. Evolution, the greatest show on earth. As we look back on the history of life, we see a picture of never-ending, ever-rejuvenating novelty.
Those animals may seem to us to be very remote, strange, even fantastic. But all of us alive today owe our very existence to them.
Do you like mystery stories? Well, we have one for you. The concept? Relativity. That strange, fantastic relationship between time, distance, and math. Before we're finished, I think you'll agree that truth is stranger than the strangest fiction.
Why do the stars shine? Why does the galaxy light up?
A equals MC squared.
That is the engine that lights up the stars.
Energy turns into mass.
E equals MC squared.
That is the secret of the stars.
That is the secret of the stars.
Now listen carefully. The faster you move, the heavier you get. The energy of motion turns into M, your mass.
Energy of motion.
Energy equals mass times the speed of light squared.
Speed of light squared.
An awful lot of energy for a tiny amount of mass.
Light travels at the same speed, no matter how you look at it.
No matter how I move relative to you,
light travels at the same speed.
No matter who is doing the measurement, and no matter what direction you are moving, the speed of light is the same. The speed of light is the same, no matter what direction or how fast.
As you travel.
travel faster. Time slows down. Everything slows down. Everything slows down.
Time slows down when you move. Time passes at a different rate. Clocks run slow.
It's a monumental shift in how we see the world.
The beauty, the majesty, the power of the universe into a single equation.
E=mc².
That is the engine that lights up the stars. Energy turns into mass.
E=mc².
That is the secret of the stars.
It's a beautiful piece of science. It's a beautifully elegant theory. It's a beautiful piece of science. It's a beautiful piece of...
A planet like the Earth is kept in orbit because it follows curves in the spatial fabric caused by the sun's presence.
Space and time are bent by stars and planets. As things move through this curved space, they bend.
Now, all of this is illustration of the fact that time and space are linked together.
As you're moving through bent and curved space and time, you feel like you feel a force. Feel like you feel a force. As you're moving through bent and curved space and time, you feel like you feel a force. That force is gravity.
The beauty, the majesty, the power of the universe into a single equation.
E=mc².
The engine that lights up the stars. Energy turns into mass.
E=mc².
That is the secret of the stars. That is the secret of the stars. That is the secret of the stars. That is the secret of the stars.
We are a flexible and innovative species, and we have the capacity to adapt and modify our behavior. Now, we most certainly have to do so if we're to deal with climate change. It's the biggest challenge we have yet faced.
The same thing that keeps the Earth warm.
That keeps the Earth warm.
CO2
may make the Earth too warm.
The Earth too warm.
It holds in heat.
Methane, chlorofluorocarbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide.
They all trap heat.
Methane, chlorofluorocarbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide.
They all trap
heat. It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes. We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers to these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this. We can change the world.
Every single thing every one of us does,
every one of us does
affects everybody all over the world. It's one global ecosystem.
Dry. Climates all start in the sky.
In the sky.
Warm, wet, cold or dry. Climates all start in the sky.
In the sky.
When the CO2 is high, the temperature is high. Moving together in lockstep. When the CO2 is low, the temperature is low. Moving together.
It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
Evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this. We can change the world.
Science offers us answers to these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Our use of fossil fuels for energy is pushing us towards a climate unlike any seen in the history of civilization.
Adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere warms things up. Warms things up.
The rise in CO2 comes from burning fossil fuels.
When you burn them, add oxygen,
it makes CO2 that goes in the air.
We're reversing the process by which they form.
We're reversing the process.
We're talking about something that affects the entire Earth. Problems that transcend nations. It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers for these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
I will travel where no man has dared to go.
Into the black hole.
Why, that's crazy.
If you fall in, you never come out. Stretching you from head to toe. Death by black hole.
There are monsters out in the cosmos that can swallow entire stars.
Inside these equations, there's a monster.
Anything that springs too close will be pulled in.
Gravity is infinite at the center of a black hole. Time stops. Space makes no sense.
Every galaxy has got one big black hole in the middle and millions of smaller black holes.
An anomaly of gravity so strange. Nothing is more seductive. Nothing.
There are monsters out in the cosmos that can swallow entire stars,
that can destroy space itself,
completely invisible.
Anything that strains too close will be pulled in.
In the last century, black holes have gone from being mathematical curiosities to real objects in the cosmos, seemingly crucial to the formation of galaxies.
Nothing can escape it, even light.
There must be millions and millions of black holes.
Millions and millions and millions.
Zipping around our galaxy. Nothing there to light them up.
Millions and millions of black holes.
Millions and millions and millions.
Zipping around our galaxy. Nothing there to light them up.
At the heart of a large black hole is a singularity.
It's a singularity.
It's a point of infinite density.
The accepted laws of physics break down. Break down. Break down.
Black holes form when giant stars run out of fuel and collapse under their own weight.
Gone remnants of burned out stars.
Truth is stranger than sci-fi.
An anomaly of gravity so strange. Nothing is more seductive.
There are monsters out in the cosmos that can swallow entire stars,
that can destroy space itself,
completely invisible.
Anything that strains too close will be pulled in.
Millions and millions of black holes,
zipping around our galaxy,
nothing there to light them up.
Millions and millions of black holes,
zipping around our galaxy,
nothing there to light them up.
Bigger and scarier than a black hole.
A boundary between the known universe and a place.